Thank you, Justin. I'd like to thank you and myself for inviting me. So this is recent work that just appeared last week, along with Dan Friedman from MIT and Hiroshi Oguri from Caltech. The work was initiated when they were both visiting here for the M-Theory program. So this is my usual advertisement for ADS-CFT, which is probably less necessary here than at some places, but I'll just review everything that we've learned by now. ADS-CFT, which relates some kind of bulk gravity theory to a boundary field theory, is a pretty mature subject. We've learned a lot both about the properties of various field theories on the boundary, as well as something about the nature of string theory itself. And here's a list of some of the things that have been accomplished. People looked at CFTs in various dimensions, calculated correlation functions, calculated Wilson loops on the field theory side using computations on the gravity side. Finite temperature field theories were investigated, which is related to black hole backgrounds on the gravity side. People also tried to learn something about gravity from field theory. It's a so-called holographic reconstruction of space-time program. And then people also turned to descriptions of non-conformal field theories using gravity. This falls under the broad category of holographic RG flows. A lot of work has been done on this in the last few years. And people even had some phenomenological applications to brain worlds and dark CFT. So with an eye towards how this will be generalized in a few minutes, I just want to review the ADS-CFT classic prescription of Maldacena. So the idea is that one starts with a collection of brains. We'll stick to the most famous example, which is a stack of ND3 brains sitting in 10-dimensional space-time. And this stack has both closed strings propagating in the bulk as well as some open strings that end on the brains. And then you consider the limit where the string scale is taken to zero while keeping the energies of fluctuations fixed. And you find that depending on the value of the so-called Hooft parameter, which is related to the string coupling and to the number of brains like this, that one of two different descriptions is the most appropriate one. When this Hooft parameter is large, you cannot ignore the back reaction of the D brains on the space-time. And the appropriate description is the near horizon limit of a black P brain solution, which is just ADS5 times S5. And you have string theory on this background, so there are closed strings propagating. However, if the Hooft coupling is small, then the back reaction of the brains on the geometry can be neglected. And the best description of the physics in this decoupling limit is just of flat hypersurfaces with open strings propagating on them. And in fact, in the alpha prime goes to zero limit, you just get the massless modes, that is the field theory limit, of these open string excitations. And the proposal of Maldacena was that these two configurations are exactly dual to one another. They describe the same physics, but are each better in a different regime of the coupling. So in particular, one thing to notice is that of the two different kinds of stringy excitations in the brain geometry before we took this alpha prime goes to zero limit, the closed strings and the open strings got segregated one from the other in the final near horizon or field theory limit, but nonetheless they're supposed to be holographically dual. One describes the same physics as the other. So I want to consider a generalization. On the field theory side, there exists a rich class of conformal field theories which are often studied in the condensed matter context, which are conformal field theories that contain some kind of a spatial defect with additional dynamics propagating on it. And despite the presence of the defect, which I've sort of drawn in a cartoon here, and despite the fact that it breaks some translational and rotational symmetries, the scale invariance and the conformal symmetry are nonetheless unbroken. I learned about theories like this from a paper of Cardi and a paper by Osborne and McCavity. So a question that one could naturally ask is whether it's possible to realize these sorts of more complicated defect conformal field theories holographically in a gravity background. And that question is what one way of motivating what I'm going to pursue today. One might also hope in the long run that one could study backgrounds like this that aren't conformal on the field theory side, but nonetheless have both sort of bulk and boundary dynamics and model that holographically. So we're going to be considering a codimension 1 defect. It separates the space-time into two regions. But it's not actually a boundary in the sense that space doesn't end at it. It keeps going through. So I want to suggest a candidate dual for this sort of a defect conformal field theory. Now, there was a proposal by Karch and Randall who are attempting to, as it's called, locally localize gravity. They're trying to generalize the Randall-Sundrum configuration. So Randall-Sundrum models involve a sort of brain world where you realize a flat brain in a higher dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And Karch and Randall were examining a solution for instead a ADS brain, an ADS4 brain inside ADS5, which was a solution that Andreas found with me and Dan Friedman and Steve Gubser a while ago. And they made two comments about this system in studying it. They also talked extensively about locally localizing gravity, but that's not going to be my focus. So their first comment was that holography could act twice on this system. So you have the usual ADS5 throat, but sitting in this throat is also an ADS4 hypersurface. And the idea is that precisely because this is an anti-de Sitter space, that in addition to the entire space holographically describing a four-dimensional field theory, that there should be additional dynamics localized on the intersection of the ADS4 brain with the boundary of ADS5. That is, this R3 defect is the boundary of ADS4. So this is exactly the sort of system we're interested in, a system where you have a defect cutting across the middle of space. And besides that holography should act twice, the second key point that Karch and Randall made was that this sort of a system can be realized in string theory. There's a configuration of three brains and five brains, N of the former and M of the latter, sitting in these dimensions, so they overlap on 2 plus 1 dimensions and then are perpendicular to each other in the rest. This background preserves 8 supercharges, and a very similar background was considered in the paper of Hanani and Witten and generalizations of that years ago for finding purely three-dimensional theories on brains. We're going to do something a little different from that. And Karch and Randall pointed out that if you take the near horizon limit of just the D3 brains with these D5 brains still sitting there, that this flat six-dimensional space that they were sitting on in the original brain configuration becomes exactly ADS4 cross S2 sitting inside the ADS5 cross S5, which is the near horizon of the three brains. So this is exactly what they were looking at and what we want to study, a realization of an ADS4 brain inside ADS5. So we'll look at this system in some detail. Just to review the symmetries here, the symmetries of the gravity background and the putative CFT dual, of course, the symmetry groups are the same on both sides, but they have different realizations. So on the gravity side, the isometries of ADS5 are broken down to the isometries of ADS4. And this corresponds to the fact on the QFT side that the four-dimensional conformal group is broken down to the three-dimensional conformal group. Translations and rotations in the fourth dimension are gone, but in particular scale invariance is preserved. Also, the isometry group of the S5 is broken down to the isometry group of this S2, as well as another SO3 that rotates around the fixed point that S2 sits on. And this is dual to the SU4R symmetry of N equals 4 super Yang Mills being broken down to an SU2 cross SU2R symmetry. And in both cases, the supersymmetry is broken in half. So just to put that, to summarize all that with a cartoon, generalizing the classic ADS-CFT we had before, we now have new ADS-CFT, where in the original brain configuration, in addition to a stack of three brains, we have a stack of five brains, intersecting them in some dimensions and overlapping in others. We're actually going to study the case where we pick just a single D5 brain for reasons that I'll explain momentarily. And there's four types of stringy excitations in this background. In addition to closed strings and the open strings that live on the three brains, there are also open strings that live on the five brain, as well as 3-5 strings, which I drew sort of big and loopy, but really should be thought of as being confined to the intersection of the three brains and the five brains on the order of the string scale. And then again, one takes the alpha prime, goes to zero limit. And again, the most appropriate description depends on whether the Hund-Hooft coupling is large or small. When the Hund-Hooft coupling is large, you can't ignore the back reaction of the three brains, and you get ADS5 cross S5. However, because we chose just one five brain, we can neglect the back reaction of the five brain in this background. Basically, G string M is just G string, and that's always going to be small. So while we have to take into account the back reaction of the three brains, and the three brains disappear and just leave us with this ADS5 geometry, in this situation, the five brain remains as a probe, with open strings still ending on it. Meanwhile, in the other side of the coin, when we have a weak Hund-Hooft coupling, well, then basically the dynamics just reduces to the open string propagation on the flat D3 brains. Open strings on the D5 brain, in this case, decouple. However, we're still left with one other kind of excitation, namely the excitations of the 3-5 strings on this defect. So this is what we imagined. On one side, we have an ADS5 geometry with an ADS4 brain sitting in it. And that should be dual to a quantum field theory that lives in four dimensions but has additional dynamics confined to three dimensions.
Why five strings are decoupled?
Well, basically because the their coupling constant is dimensionful and depends on alpha prime. And as you take alpha prime to zero, they become infinitely heavy and decouple. Yes, their motion is frozen. They don't fluctuate in that limit. It's no different from when Hanani and Witten studied three brains and five brains and took an alpha prime goes to zero limit. So they found fluctuations involving the three brains, but not those of the five brains. The 5-5 strings were frozen out. So I just wanted to point out again the four original kinds of fluctuations, stringy fluctuations in the brain configuration, again have been segregated. On the one side, we have closed strings and 5-5 strings. On the other side, we have the field theory descendants of 3-3 strings and 3-5 strings. And the proposal is that these are, again, exactly holographically dual one to the other.
From the point of view of four-dimensional theory, this is like just a domain wall?
From the point of it should not be thought of as a solution in the theory that was already there. It should rather be thought of, and I'll write down the Lagrangian later, as additional dynamics that you've actually added to the action. So there's something new there. So this is the system we're going to study. And we're going to construct, in particular, this field theory, which the proposal, if you believe this holographic dual, should be an exactly superconformal field theory of a novel sort, which we call a defect superconformal field theory. So, are there any more questions at this point? I will go on to summarize the results now.
Why do you only have one and not M?
Well, we studied one because it's the simplest case. So certainly if M were large the way N is large, we might have to consider the gravitational back reaction of this as well. But your question may be, why don't I have two or three? And there's probably no obstruction to doing that. It's a simple generalization of the field theory. We just studied the very simplest case. So, yeah, I don't see why not. So if you separate them before taking the near horizon limit, they might be at different points along the three brain, which means they'd actually be sitting at different points inside ADS5. So it's not, in some cases, if you separate brains and then take a near horizon limit, some go infinitely far away. But that would not be true in this case. So yeah, you should still be able to explore things like that, I guess Higgs branches in this sort of a setup.
Presumably, because it is a probe, in the case when M is very small, probably you don't get anything interesting there, right? If you just have the only interesting thing might happen if they are on top of one. Mm-hmm. Might get some enhanced.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what counts as interesting or not, but I think from this point of view, they would be probes basically stuck there.
Right, non-interacting
and
probes.
They would not interact, right. Yeah, I mean, because the string stretch between them would be very heavy. Right, but you could still explore having them a small bit away and how this corresponds to the field theory. Yeah. So here's a summary of what I'm going to talk about today. I've broken into two categories, the holography side and the defect conformal field theory side. So on the gravity side, I'm going to show that using the sort of a picture of an ADS-4 brain sitting in ADS-5, you can take the usual prescription for calculating correlation functions in ADS-CFT and reproduce the sorts of novel correlation functions that can appear in defect CFTs. What those are, I'll explain just on the next transparency. So this is a good first check that it's possible to get the right coordinate dependence of the correlation functions. And then the next thing we'll do is actually perform the reduction of the open string modes living on the D5 brain, the KK reduction on the S2, so that they just become ADS5 modes. And this will give us a whole set of fluctuations on the gravity side, which need to be holographically mapped to certain gauge invariant composite operators confined to the defect on the other side. And we will, in fact, construct this map and find that everything matches up as it should once we explore the field theory. And the field theory itself will construct, as I said, it's a novel kind of theory as far as I know, a defect superconformal field theory. It has an exact Lagrangian description. It's not that it flows somewhere conformal, but it is itself exactly conformal, just like n equals 4 super Young-Mills. It has 8 supercharges and this R symmetry. Now, certainly if you believe holography, this theory just is conformal. That's what the fact that it's dual to something with ADS-4 isometries tells you. But it certainly would be nice to see this from the field theory side. And at this point, this is still work in progress for us. We have an incomplete proof of the conformality from perturbation theory. It constitutes a total proof for the gauge group U1, which of course is not holographically dual to what we have. We have SUN with N large. But we also have indications that once the proof is finished, it will, in fact, prove to be exactly conformal. There's really not too many things that can go wrong. And finally, I'll comment on the fact that unlike the familiar case of the N equals 4 super Young-Mills holography, there's an absence of a generic non-renormalization theorem that would keep the coefficients of correlators the same from large-Hooft coupling to small-Hooft coupling. But I will point out a candidate for a set of correlators that may still prove to be protected. So, are there any questions at this point? Next, I'll tell you a little bit about defect conformal field theories and what's generally known about them, just sort of a real bare minimum introduction. So the top half is just review. We know that in regular CFTs, the correlation functions of composite operators are very constrained by the conformal symmetry. The two-point function, the coordinate dependence is determined, there's only a constant that's free, and the conformal dimensions of the two operators need to be the same. Three-point functions, it's determined up to a constant for the arbitrary three conformal dimensions. And then by the time you get to a four-point function, it's possible to have one function of the cross ratios, which are the conformal invariant functions of the coordinates that become possible. Now there's a very analogous set of simplest correlation functions that arise in a defect conformal field theory. So here I'm going to use the notation where x is the single coordinate perpendicular to the defect, while the y coordinates are along it, and O4 will be a regular four-dimensional composite operator, which can be defined anywhere in the ambient space, while O3 will be an operator that is only allowed to live on the defect. And in this case, one finds that one-point functions for four-dimensional operators become possible. Their coordinate dependence is determined, and there's only a constant's worth of freedom. You can also have mixed two-point functions between four and three-dimensional operators. Again, the coordinate dependence is determined, and is up to a constant. And then one can also have two-point functions. Before we had the defect, we had two-point functions where the conformal dimensions had to be the same. It's now possible to have two-point functions where the conformal dimensions need not be the same, and this is up to an arbitrary function of the coordinates. So as I'm sure you can see, there's a strong analogy between these three and these three, which I've hinted at by making them the same color.
That's right.
That's where these come from. Mm-hmm. Sure. So, Carol.
What characterizes a defect? In two dimensions, a defect, which is a boundary, can be characterized by a boundary state.
Mm-hmm.
So analogous here.
Well, I mean, what characterizes it for us in this case is that there will be additional fields living on the defect, and one can construct operators that, because they contain those fields, are localized on the defect. I mean, that's from an operator point of view. One can then, I haven't looked at it from the point of view of the Hilbert space, but the Hilbert space would be created by acting on the vacuum with those operators.
This just fell from the conformal.
Yeah, everything here you could just derive from the algebra.
What constraints are there in three-point functions?
Well, three-point, you mean in the defect case. Well, it's even less constrained. I don't know offhand exactly what their form can be like. But certainly, if the two-point function can have an arbitrary function out front, the three-point function can as well. This computing this guy is as complicated as computing this four-point function. So the three-point functions would be analogous to five or six-point functions in the regular CFT.
Well, it looks like they're just related by integers.
That's exactly right. That was actually my next comment. Mm-hmm. So one can derive these coordinates by taking these correlation functions and then placing the two or three or four different operators at image locations on either side of the defect, and you get the same sort of coordinate dependence. Yeah?
Can you also consider three-dimensional operators?
Right, so O3 with O3 is just like this. The O3s will just behave like O4s would in the original conformal field theory. As far as they're concerned, they're just living in a three-dimensional CFT. Yeah, Alex?
Could you remind in just a standard way, when you compute the four-dimensional four-operator correlation function, there will be a function, right?
Yeah.
Is this function, is there at least in any book case, another normalization theorem which tells us that this function should be the same, for large group coupling and for small group coupling?
No, I don't think there's a normalization theorem for the four-point functions. That function can change. Right, so what I'm going to find is that there is not a non-renormalization function protecting these.
Okay.
Even this one, which is the very simplest, generically, this C will be a function of Wiedehoft coupling and will change from weak to strong coupling.
But in particular, that function F of psi would also...
Definitely. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to see if supergravity, if holography, can compute these correlation functions. So, just a reminder of the prescription for calculating correlation functions holographically. This was the original prescription of Gubser, Klebanoff, Polyakov, and Witten. And the idea is that ADS-CFT basically boils down to the statement that the string partition function evaluated with certain boundary data for the fields is exactly equal to the generating function for CFT correlation functions, where the boundary data plays the role of sources for various gauge invariant operators. And we're using the Wiedehoft limit, where the Wiedehoft coupling is very large, and that means that the string partition function just reduces to the exponential of the classical supergravity action evaluated on the solution to the equations of motion. And then the way one calculates correlation functions, obviously, is differentiating with respect to the source, which becomes differentiating with respect to boundary data on the gravity side. The action for the Karch-Randall system is the action of type 2b string theory, as well as the action for the open string modes living on the D5 brain, which I've split into Born-Infeld and Wessamino pieces, like so. And we expect that the new correlation functions, like the one-point function, these mixed two-point functions, will come from the interaction of open string modes as well as closed string modes inside these pieces here. And that's what we'd like to see. Just a brief comment, which I'll come back to at the end. One can calculate the dependence on N and on the Hooft coupling that comes from this action. It's well known that the type 2B action can be written as going like N squared, which matches well with the field theory. These pieces go like a single power of N, which is more or less what you might expect because it's 1 over G string instead of 1 over G string squared. But then they also go like the Hooft coupling to the 1/2. The strange power more or less comes because you've got a 5 brain and a background of 3 brains, and the powers don't really match up. So this strange dependence on the coupling is going to be what leads to not having the same coupling dependence on the field theory side as on the gravity side. So we'll come back to this later. Just file it away in the back of your minds. And now, as promised, we'll indicate the calculation of the one-point function and also the mixed two-point function from gravity. So we imagine there's some composite operator that moves in all four dimensions, dual to some closed string mode. On the gravity side, the closed string mode has a kinetic term living in the 2B action. You can expand it out in spherical harmonics on S5 and get a whole tower of modes. But we imagine that there's also a coupling on the D5 brain action that just looks like a single power of the closed string field. Just the phi integrated over the 6 coordinates of the 5 brain. And again, you can do a KK reduction on the S2 to get a coupling of ADS4 fields. So you have this field, here's its kinetic term and a mass, but it also has a 1-point coupling. And if you follow the usual prescription that I outlined in the last transparency, you find that the 1-point function of the dual operator exactly has the coordinate dependence that you expect, has this coupling dependence that I just mentioned, as well as having a certain dependence on the conformal dimension involved. So that's good. And similarly, for the two-point function of O4 and O3, you imagine that you have an operator confined to the defect, it's dual to a D5 brain mode, and they have some sort of coupling like this in ADS4. And given that, you find that, yes, you calculate a two-point function, again, with exactly the right coordinate dependence. Yeah, we do understand the poles and the zeros. So there's basically two classes. One class of poles basically indicates an ultraviolet divergence in the dual field theory, which we can show heuristically with the general power counting argument. And the more interesting class of poles that comes in here is actually similar to a class of poles that appeared in a generic three-point function for ADS-CFT. So it was found that, how much of this do I really want to explain? Basically, there are certain kinds of three-point functions that to really calculate them from the 2B action, you found that they had both interactions with derivatives and without derivatives. This was done in a paper by Seiberg, Lee, Rangamani, and Minwala a while ago. They did a transformation from one set of fields to another that eliminated the derivative couplings. But in that case, they found that actually the integrals blew up and the coupling constants went to zero. And it was shown later by some MIT people that if you don't make this sort of singular transformation in that case and keep the derivative couplings, that everything just works out smoothly. So some of these poles are analogous infinities coming from the integral over ADS4. And so the proposal, which we haven't actually checked in concrete cases, is that either you also have derivative couplings or the coupling itself has to approach zero to compensate for that sort of divergence. But it's exactly analogous to old three-point functions.
Is it known how you normalize operators when you compute this correlation function generically when you compute field theory gravity correspondence?
Right. So,
to be
safe, all of the statements I'll make later on involve normalizing the correlation functions by dividing them out, basically by the square root of the two-point function. Okay. So it's a normalization where the two-point function
so
is sort of
using,
yeah.
Except that here, the two-point function has its some shared function.
So one can still consider the two-point function of an operator with itself, and that's what we normalize. I mean, basically, there are mixings between operators and other operators, but they're all subleading in 1 over n. So you would ignore them in the 1 over n expansion compared to the original two-point function if it were not zero. So you only take into account that the mixing in the case where there's no mixing to leading order in 1 over n. So that's good. What I just said was very generic. I was just sort of taking arbitrary couplings. I wasn't deriving them particularly from the action of a D5 brain. But we also performed the Klutze-Klein decomposition of the system we're actually studying, the D5 brain sitting in the ADS5 background. I won't go through all the details because it's not really that illuminating, but there is a gauge field living on the 5 brain which splits into an ADS4 piece and a sphere piece. There are scalars parameterizing the different fluctuations of the 5 brain. The Born-Enfeld action gives them kinetic terms, and you actually find that because of the n units of 3 brain charge, or the 5 form flux from the 3 brain sitting in the background, that there's actually a quadratic coupling between one of these scalars as well as the gauge field on the sphere, polarized on the sphere. So that has to be taken into account even at the quadratic level. So we analyzed all of these fluctuations of 3 scalars in the 7, 8, 9 directions are free. They have a really simple wave equation. You find some ADS masses when you reduce it on S2, and you can calculate the dual conformal dimensions, and this is what you find. There is a tachyon here at the bottom of the tower, but it satisfies the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman stability bound in 3 dimensions. And then the other sorts of fluctuations. There's the ADS4 gauge field, which just reduces to an equation for a Maxwell field and a lot of massive one forms. And finally, there's this coupled system between one of the scalars and the gauge field on the sphere. So that can be solved. Remember, this off-diagonal coupling came from the Wessamino piece. And despite the fact that you have to diagonalize a 2x2 matrix and take a square root, you find that the masses are integers. And then again, to get the dual conformal dimensions, you have to take a second square root. And again, you find integer results despite that. So if you just wrote down an arbitrary equation here and changed some coefficients, you wouldn't be getting rational, or as we're getting, integral dual conformal dimensions, but we do, which is basically just a result of supersymmetry. So this is a nice check that we didn't make a mistake. And again, there are a couple of modes here that are tachyonic, but they satisfy the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. So this list of modes that I've just zoomed through here are all of the 5 brain modes, the 5-5 string modes on the gravity side. So we expect all of these guys to be dual to various gauge invariant operators that are confined to the defect. And we'll construct that dictionary momentarily.
And you don't expect renormalization of the scaling exponents.
No, I don't, because these, like the case in just n equals 4 super Yang Mills, they sit in short multiplets of the supergroup, and so they won't change their conformal dimension. So I'll go about constructing that dictionary momentarily. I just wanted to mention very briefly, so earlier I did sort of these generic calculations of 1 and 2-point functions. I just wanted to show you the sorts of terms that actually appear in the Karch-Randall system. So for example, the Born-Enfeld term does give rise to a 1-point function for the dilaton. So the dilaton will have a 1-point function in this background. There's also this sort of term that mixes a graviton fluctuation with a derivative of one of the scalars on the 5 brain, so that will generate this sort of interaction. And these are just samples. There are lots more. There are more coming from the Wessamino term. So to actually do this, one would, for example, take that dilaton coupling. The dilaton is a 10-dimensional guy, so you've got to expand it in harmonics on the S5. but then this interaction is localized on S2. So when you restrict the S5 to S2, it sets some of the quantum numbers to zero, and you integrate, it sets some more quantum numbers to zero, and you find that only a subset of all the modes of the dilaton reduced on the S5 actually will receive this sort of a one-point function. Or the subset turns out to be exactly those that are invariant under the remaining R symmetry, as you might expect. So I now want to turn to a discussion of the field theory, which will take up the rest of my talk. So before I start talking about field theory, are there any questions? Yeah, correct.
Question about effect, what characterizes the effect. In two dimensions, there is analog of Cardi condition, which comes from the fact that you can expand two bulk operators in the bulk operator and then couple it to the boundary, or you can first couple two bulk things to the boundary and then couple them.
When you say couple, you mean like Wick contract or take the two-point function?
Two-point function,
yeah.
And there is a Cardi condition which tells you that the result doesn't depend on what you do.
Right. So this is something like the in regular CFT when you have a four-point function and you can sort of do it either way, right? Yeah, something analogous does exist in this case. Yeah. Yeah.
But then it should constrain a two-point function and one-point function.
Yes, that's true. So there are things that one can do that I haven't done, like expand one can expand four-dimensional operators in a sort of operator product expansion in terms of three-dimensional operators near the boundary. You can play those sorts of games and use them to analyze the system. So
in two dimensions, it turns out that solutions are kind of labels that label the boundary. Set of solutions having one-to-one correspondence with boundary conditions.
Okay, one thing I need to make clear is that we're not imposing boundary conditions. So this is something you could do, but in our theory, what you have is four-dimensional fields, three-dimensional fields, and interactions that involve both types. But you don't have a boundary condition saying that, for example, the four-dimensional fields have to vanish or their derivatives have to vanish at the defect. That we don't have, because space just continues through them.
But the fields interact.
They do interact.
So in effect, there are equations which are localized in the boundary.
Oh, absolutely. I just want to separate sort of interactions from boundary conditions. Actions from boundary conditions.
Well, what is called boundary conditions in 2D is not same.
Oh, okay. It may be interactions.
It's basically boundary conditions are labels for solutions of the Cardi equation.
So you can always get boundary conditions by going to multipliers.
Yeah.
It's like extra field.
Right. Sure. Yeah, I guess you could do that at a field that doesn't have a kinetic term. So, yeah.
It seems to me that if you solve the analog of Cardi equation here, you also get some constraints on what boundary can look like. What boundary conditions.
Well, the constraint is going to get constraints which come from the claim that this is controlling the ground.
Right. And a supersymmetry as well. So.
In 2D, there is discrete labels.
Yeah, I don't know if there's an analog for that or not. I certainly haven't looked at. I haven't seen it in my limited knowledge of these things. But yeah, I mean, anything for two dimensions that doesn't involve the fact that the two-dimensional conformal group is infinite dimensional would carry over here. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about it later. Cause I'm not sure I know what to match the labels to. All right. So as I promised, I am going to construct a dictionary between those Kaluza-Klein fluctuations I just derived and some field theory operators. But first, I just want to run through the cast of characters in the field theory. So. For one thing, moving in the total four-dimensional space is just the usual fields of N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, which I've indicated here. So the gauge field splits up into A sub K, where K is 0, 1, and 2, and A sub 6, the fact that it's 6 and not 3 is lost in the mists of convention for these sorts of brain backgrounds, but that's what tends to be used. Because the 5 brain is put on 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the 3 brain is 0, 1, 2, 6. And then the 6 scalars get split into sets of 3 and 3 more, because remember, the SO6 was broken into SO3 cross SO3. So we have a triplet of one SO3, a triplet of the other SO3. These are the 3, 4, 5 scalars, and these are the 7, 8, 9 scalars. And we also have the 4 gay genotes, which are a 2, 2 of the SU2 cross SU2. And then we also have fields living on the defect. We know just from string theory, people have analyzed the 3-5 strings, that what we get is a hypermultiplet charged under the gauge group. So we have some scalars and as well as some hyperenos, which are in these doublets of the 2 different SU2s. And they're in the fundamental of the gauge group. And then these are all the symmetries, like I said. There's an SU2 cross SU2R symmetry, 3-dimensional Lorentz invariance is preserved, as well as N equals 4 in 3 dimensions, which is 8 supercharges. There's the SUN gauge group, and there's also a U1 that acts only on the defect fields, which we call U1 sub B. So these are our friends, and from them we construct the operators that are dual to fluctuations on the 5 brain. As I mentioned before, these fit into not just multiplets, but short multiplets of the supergroup. This is the group that contains all those symmetries I wrote on the last transparency. So the first thing we did is to identify the lowest of this infinite tower of short multiplets, the ground floor multiplet. And based on the symmetries, there's a unique candidate for a chiral primary, which is this SU2 triplet built out of the scalar fields on the defect, and it matches exactly the bottom of one of the towers we found on the Kaluza-Klein side, one of the 2 towers that came from diagonalizing that 2x2 matrix. So then if this is really a chiral primary, its descendants ought to also be there in the multiplet, and they will match other modes on the gravity side. And so using supersymmetry, we find these 2 guys. And indeed, we can match them exactly to the lowest mode of 2 more of the towers that we found on the gravity side, so that's nice. And one of them, one of the descendants of this, is just the current of this U1 symmetry that I just mentioned. It's not an R symmetry, it's just a global symmetry that rotates the whole hypermultiplet that lives on the defect. And this is exactly dual to the massless gauge field that was at the bottom of the tower of ADS4 fields on the gravity side. So this is good. Something that I won't go into, but is also true, is that one can use certain T-duality arguments on the action that I'm going to derive later to show from another point of view that these are the correct operators to identify as duals to the gravity modes. And indeed, the T-duality argument confirms this identification. So this is the ground floor multiplet. Then there's an infinite tower of higher multiplets. And in general, moving up one rung in this tower involves putting some operator, at least for the chiral primaries, it involves adding some operator inside the chiral primary on the floor below. So for example, in N equals 4 Super-Yang Mills, if you have some operator trace F squared, then the one in the next tower up will be trace F squared times the scalar X, and then each time you move up another rung in the tower, you get another X. So in this case, the symmetries involved actually give us 2 different candidates for what could be the operator to insert to get the higher floor chiral primaries. Either 3 of the 6 scalars, or actually symmetries don't rule out using this operator composed entirely of defect fields. So the second floor chiral primary might look like either this or this. Again, it's not worth going into the argument, but there's a T-duality argument that suggests that, in fact, this is the only choice that's consistent with supersymmetry. This is also more or less what you would expect, sort of on general grounds, that when you're matching this to, that's probably, saying that is probably more complicated than I really need to be. So massive gravitons, I haven't talked very much about the identification of the closed string modes. To leading order, they continue to be identified with the same four-dimensional operators they're identified with before.
There are some which are dual to open strings, and there are some which are dual to closed strings.
So on the gravity side, you have basically the closed string modes have boundary data that stretches throughout the boundary of ADS5, which is R4, while the five brain modes have boundary data only on the boundary of ADS4, which is R3. Therefore, they must be sources for operators defined either over all four coordinates or just over three. Now, to leading order, the closed string modes, which were there before I added the defect, are still going to be dual to the same operators on the field theory side that they were before.
In parental capture scenarios, there are massive modes appearing because of bound states.
Good. So in the case where the gravitational back reaction of the D5 brain is strong, then you cannot neglect the impact it has on the closed string modes, even to leading order. And you have to solve for the graviton in that background.
And so there would be closed strings fields bound to those effects.
Yes. I mean, basically, I think in the case where M, the number of D5 brains, is also large like N, you would find that you have to remove the D5 brain, replace it with its gravitational back reaction. The gravity description would only be closed strings. There would not be any open strings at all. And the difference between those dual to fields in four dimensions and those confined to the defect would be whether or not those modes were locally localized or not on the gravity side. So that's the expectation. That actually hasn't been confirmed because no one knows the solution with the D5 brain back reaction. I guess your question goes nicely into this comment that I was going to make very briefly. So I've completely fixed here the open string operator map to defect operators. This determines all the chiral primaries, and in principle, their Suzy descendants, which you can calculate, are matched to the various towers on the gravity side. One can ask about the closed strings, and there will be some corrections. So we know the graviton is dual to the stress tensor, but we don't expect it to be just the stress tensor of N equals 4 Subriang-Mills, but to also have this delta function part, which is the stress tensor on the defect. Similarly, the dilaton is dual to the total Lagrangian before we added the defect. Now we expect it to be dual to the total Lagrangian, including the defect piece. So beyond this is an open question, which we did not study. How are the other closed string operators corrected by the presence of the defect? There's a lot one could learn there.
Can you at least say something how the two pieces have the same scaling with Hood coupling, for example, or the defect piece is subdominant?
Well, I think so. These two are the only ones we know, and it's because we didn't have to calculate them. We just knew that the stress tensor, which we expect to be, you know, conserved as well as to be traceless, involves the whole thing. And the Lagrangian is the whole thing. And this should not be corrected. I mean, the Lagrangian is what it is, regardless of the Itthoff coupling, and the same as the stress tensor. But other operators dual to other bulk modes, we don't know. In principle, there's all sorts of subleading corrections in N, too. Okay, well, let me move on from the operator map, which worked out exactly as we hoped. We did succeed in matching those five brain modes to the set of defect operators, and that was very nice, to now constructing the field theory. So how are we going to do this? Well, you know, in principle, you could do this by actually calculating string theory on the background of three brains, five brains, calculating the 3-5 strings and their interaction with 3-3 strings. It's actually been brought to my attention very recently that some things like this were done years ago by Sav Seti and a few of his collaborators. He worked with Kapustin and he worked with Ganor. They were not studying conformal field theories, but they did study some brain intersections and the field theories associated with them that also had a delta function localized part. And they actually did it by using string theory. But we thought a simpler way of doing it would be just to use supersymmetry. So we're going to make the following assumptions. We're going to assume that the dynamics in the four-dimensional space, which I'm usually going to call the ambient space, is just N equals 4 Subriang-Mills. Moreover, we're going to assume that the fields on the defect is a hypermultiplet. We get that from string theory. And in the fundamental representation of the gauge group, which means it has to couple in a certain way to the 0, 1, and 2 components of the ambient gauge field. And this is really all we're going to assume. And we're going to derive the complete action using that and supersymmetry. So let me just mention, the presence of the defect breaks the supersymmetry of n equals 4 super Yang Mills in half. And so this is the way that the n equals 4 four-dimensional vector multiplet splits into three-dimensional multiplets. Notice that the gauge field gets split. The 0, 1, and 2 components are in one multiplet. A6 is in another. Three scalars here, three scalars there. And the four-dimensional spinners break into two-component 3D spinners and split down the middle. We're going to find, since the defect hypermultiplet has to couple to this part of the bulk gauge field, that it couples to this entire vector multiplet. It actually does not couple to the three-dimensional hypermultiplet at all. So now, this is our goal. Using these inputs, we're going to construct this field theory consistent with the supersymmetries and the R-symmetry. So there comes a question now. We have these fields moving in the ambient space. We have fields on the defect. We need to construct interactions involving both kinds of fields, but that are localized on the defect, that respect supersymmetry. So what is the most efficient way to basically take the four-dimensional multiplets, split them into three-dimensional multiplets, and construct supersymmetric invariant interactions on the defect using those guys as well as the fundamentally three-dimensional fields? And the answer that seemed the easiest to us is to use the so-called superspace boundary technique, which I learned about from a paper of Kentaro Hori. It may be much older. The idea is the following. You have four-dimensional supermultiplets, which we can arrange into superfields of n equals 1 supersymmetry. I'm going to use n equals 1 superspace just because it's what's most familiar. And supersymmetry is realized on these superfields using a differential operator here, which we call S. This is very familiar. Now, when you break the Lorentz invariance from four-dimensional to three-dimensional, this four-component spinner, I wrote it in a Majorana form, so it's four-component, splits into two-component spinners of the three-dimensional Lorentz group, which contain derivatives of both the three directions and also the one direction perpendicular to the defect. Now, basically, what we do is we notice that since the defect breaks translations in the x direction, we can't have any supercharges floating around that anti-commute to this broken translation. Those supercharges must also be broken. Supercharges must also be broken by the defect. Therefore, we can construct from these guys unbroken supersymmetries by finding some kind of a generator here where the dx, the x derivative, has vanished. So the choice we make, you could make other choices, it's conventional, is to let theta 2, which is two of the four components of this original 4D anti-commuting coordinate, be 0. Now we call theta 1 some fat theta. And then the first of these two-component spinners becomes exactly the three-dimensional realization of n equals 1 3D supersymmetry. So this is how we see the preserved three-dimensional supersymmetry, the half of supersymmetry that is preserved by the defect, sitting inside the total supersymmetry that existed before the defect. Now, there, of course, exist some fundamentally three-dimensional superfields that transform in the usual way, which is generated by that differential operator that I just showed. But the magic of the superspace boundary technique is that one can very easily make three-dimensional superfields from four-dimensional superfields by restricting them to the so-called superspace boundary. So we get a three-dimensional superfield depending only on the three coordinates as well as the half of the anti-commuting variables that are preserved by taking the four-dimensional guy, restricting it to the defect, but also setting theta 2 equal to 0. And you can show that this guy transforms exactly like a three-dimensional superfield, namely that the four-dimensional transformation reduces properly to the three-dimensional transformation. So this technique, which is really kind of elegant, enables us to create these three-dimensional superfields easily from four-dimensional ones, and then three-dimensional interactions can be constructed in the usual way. We just take a product of these three-dimensional fields, whether they were fundamentally 3D or came from 4D fields, and integrate over the two superspace coordinates that we have left. And this gives an action that's invariant under three-dimensional n equals 1 supersymmetry. So this is the program we're going to use. Because we're working in n equals 1 superspace, the actions we'll construct are manifestly 4-dimensional n equals 1 broken to 3-dimensional n equals 1, but we'll prove that what we find is actually n equals 4 supersymmetry invariant by identifying the R symmetry. The R symmetry combined with n equals 1 supersymmetry and the closure of the algebra demonstrates that it's n equals 4.
Why does this not scale?
What?
This doesn't look very scalable.
Well, so what we're going to construct is an action that involves no dimensionful parameters, and classically that's really all you know. So until you actually do field theory calculations, you can only make two arguments. One is you can say, well, this has to be the holographic dual of this gravity picture, and therefore it better be conformally invariant. And the other thing you can say is, well, I'm going to actually calculate things and show that it's conformally invariant. And as I said, we've proven that for the U1 gauge group, and we're in the process for all of them. You'll see that the symmetries are very restrictive. There aren't that many things that can happen. So just a reminder, n equals 4 super Yang Mills is made up of a vector superfield and 3 adjoint chiral superfields in the n equals 1 language. There's a superpotential. We'll put the defect hypermultiplet into a complex 3-dimensional superfield with an index that runs over 1 and 2. And because it's getting late, I'll go through this not in extraordinary detail. But the first thing we need to do is get the kinetic terms of the 3-dimensional fields to include their canonical coupling to the restriction of the 4-dimensional gauge field. So the way we do that is we take the 4-dimensional vector multiplet, take its derivative, take one of the components, restrict it to the superspace boundary, and we get this particular 3-dimensional guy, which is called a connection superfield. And then we find that the covariant derivative built from the 3-dimensional superspace derivative and this connection superfield is exactly what we need to generate kinetic terms for the 3-dimensional hypermultiplet. So you write down the superspace action. When you expand it out, you find that you've done just what you wanted. You've given covariant derivatives that couple these guys to the restriction of the 4D gauge field. But this can't be the whole story, of course, since this is a restriction of the 4D vector superfield. There are also the 3 4D adjoint chiral superfields, which contain, for example, the other 3 of the 4 gauginos, and those gauginos form a multiplet under the preserved R symmetry, so we have to have more Yukawa couplings besides just these. We need some sort of completion. So in order to do that, we define these big X's, which are more restrictions. These are restrictions of the adjoint chiral superfields to the superspace boundary. And I won't go into all these details, but I will mention that interestingly, besides involving 3 of the scalars, they also involve the derivatives in the broken direction, transverse to the brain, of the other 3 scalars, as well as fermions and the usual bulk auxiliary terms. And this piece is sort of interesting and will prove to be vital for us. Normally it just comes with a partial derivative, but we add these things to covariantize the derivative because we need to preserve 4D gauge invariants. To the defect. So we actually showed, and I'll talk about it in a moment, that all of those are ruled out by the symmetries. Right, so this is my claim for the total superspace action. So this plus the n equals 4 super Yang Mills action is the whole thing in superspace. This is basically just a 3-point coupling, the 2 defect superfields, and this restriction of the chirals. And these are the kinetic terms I wrote down before. And this is the minimal possible thing, that given the gauge invariance and the coupling to the gauge field and the n equals 4 supersymmetry. Now, this doesn't make all the symmetries manifest, obviously, because the symmetries are R symmetries. You won't see them all in superspace. So to actually see the symmetries of this, I need to go to the component formalism. Now, don't be scared. It's color-coded.
Less than transparency.
Yeah. So the green, so the R symmetry is SU2 cross SU2, where the scalars on the defect transform under one and the hyperenos transform under the other SU2. The kinetic terms are obviously invariant. all the Yukawa terms, you can now assemble these four Geijinos and O's into a four Geijinos into a 2,2 of SU2 plus SU2, show that that's invariant. These red terms, also exactly invariant. By the way, I wrote on the last transparency, besides just the fact that it was a cubic coupling of fields, there was a particular coefficient in the square root of 2, as well as this Pauli matrix. So both the square root of 2 and the Pauli matrix are vital, first of all, to assemble this into the right Geijino, and as well to make this into a triplet, so it can transform right with these scalars from the ambient space. And then finally, there are also these auxiliary fields. There's both defect auxiliary fields, little f, and the four-dimensional auxiliary fields, big F. And we've used up all of our freedom by this point, so SU2 cross SU2 R symmetry, being a symmetry of those auxiliary terms, is sort of non-trivial. And it actually works out in a very elegant way in that the potential coming entirely from the defect auxiliary fields contains one term that's not SU2 cross SU2 invariant, but that cancels against a piece that comes from the four-dimensional auxiliary fields. Because now, thanks to the coupling, when you solve algebraically for the four-dimensional auxiliary field, it contains not just the usual n equals 4 piece, but also a delta function localized term, as well as these q's. So these guys cancel. In effect, the defect knows that the theory that moves in all four dimensions is n equals 4 super Yang Mills. If it were anything else, this wouldn't work. So that's good. We've now shown that that's the action I wrote down is n equals 4 supersymmetric with the right R symmetry. Has a very strange potential term also that has its explicit delta of 0 out front, which looks very weird. We're actually not the first person to see it. I thought we were the second. We're actually the third. So Mirabelli and Peskin found this a while ago when they were looking at simple models of Hojava-Witten type physics with bulk and boundary interactions. And they claimed that it's actually not only not pathological, but necessary. They regulated it in a well-defined way and found that it was necessary to cancel other divergences to preserve the properties of supersymmetry. So this has been seen before. And actually, again, I found that Saab-Seti has seen things like this in his investigation some years ago. And finally, this goes along with a question that David asked. So in effect, what I've shown you is that there's a sort of the minimal interactions that I can have consistent with gauge invariance, and the symmetries seem to work, but maybe there are more interactions also consistent with the symmetries. In particular, other marginal terms would involve other dimensionless coupling constants that might run with scale. But you can actually show that none of them are consistent with the symmetries. For example, you might try to have a term involving only the defect fields, which gives you like scalar to the sixth power, as well as these scalar squared Yukawa terms. But it turns out that some of the terms in that sort of interaction are not SU2 cross SU2 invariant. They violate the R symmetry. And you can also imagine localizing the fields of n equals 4 super Yang Mills on the defect. For example, how about a Chern-Simons term for the restriction of the bulk gauge field? Well, it turns out that that's related by supersymmetry to a sort of mass term for the fermions, but that in turn is related to this term, which mixes three of the scalars with the other three, and that breaks the R symmetry. So this is also ruled out. There are a few others that I didn't mention that are ruled out. So as far as we know, hoping that we haven't missed any cases, all possible terms are ruled out by the symmetries except the ones we wrote down.
So you really had a term on the coupling between the free field theory on the boundary and n equals 4 theory.
If you like. Yeah, I mean, and you can imagine sort of dialing up the coupling from 0 to, say there's some coupling H for the hypermultiplet, dialing it from 0 until H equals G, exactly.
Then separate those couplings?
You could if you wanted. It wouldn't be an n equals 4 supersymmetric theory anymore, but you could. Yeah, so for it to be n equals 4 supersymmetric, there's only one coupling. The gauge coupling is the only coupling. And this really strongly constrains the possible quantum corrections. Basically, you can't have anything except a correction to the gauge coupling. So that's nice. We claim that So far, there's no connection to the gauge coupling, and we think it's moving in the direction of there being none at all. I'm basically at the end. I just wanted to make two short comments. The first one is about perturbation theory. I said this already, but one can actually do computations of examples of simple one and two-point functions and compare them to the suitably normalized correlators from gravity. And as I said, you just find different powers of the Itt-Hooft coupling. The factors of n match, which is good. That's what you expect. But the Itt-Hooft coupling, which need not match, in fact does not match. There is, however, one candidate for correlators that might be protected, and it would be interesting to investigate them further, and that is correlators with two defect fields as well as any number of ambient fields. So in particular, just the two-point function.
Just the defect correlation.
Right, so just the defect correlator is a special case of this, where the number of four dimensionals is zero. So indeed, that guy doesn't depend on the coupling constant, and that could be protected. That probably is protected.
That sort of has the biggest
Right. That's right. The four-dimensional ones lost some from the defect, but these guys, as far as they know, it's just a three-dimensional world, and they've got conformal symmetry. So, but in principle, as far as we know, you can add an arbitrary number of O4 operators and still find that to leading order, it doesn't depend on lambda. So that is something that needs to be investigated. And finally, I did construct for you this action, which is classically n equals 4 supersymmetric, satisfies the R symmetry, and is classically scale invariant. And the question, is this quantum conformal? Now, of course, the gravity dual says it is. As I mentioned, most things are ruled out so that only the gauge coupling remains. And so we've proven for a restricted class of correlators that, in fact, there is no renormalization. Basically, whenever you calculate a two-point function for the ambient fields that nonetheless are sitting on the defect, you find that there is no renormalization. And this basically means that for a theory that is free in the ambient space and only interacts on the defect, like the U1 gauge group, for example, that it is exactly conformal. It is exactly conformal. Note that the U1 gauge group is not a free field theory, because the fields in the bulk, they don't interact with each other, but they interact with the defect, so they could come back and interact with each other through loops in that way. So this is suggestive. We haven't finished the proof of conformality yet. We hope to do that pretty soon. But certainly the indications that we have in our sort of informal computations that aren't good enough to be up here yet are that conformal invariance does in fact hold. So let me conclude.
As a U1 theory, say, what gets that? Cancellations that take place are between 1 and 1.
So in the U1 theory, basically the reason the U1 theory is simpler is because the first interaction of a bulk field has to be on the defect. The first thing it can do is split into defect fields. So you compute the contributions from the scalars running around and the fermions running around. And I haven't gone into it in any detail, but in some cases it's not even that there's a cancellation. It's simply that because of the powers of the propagators, and because you have three-dimensional fields instead of four-dimensional fields, that things work out to be finite instead of actually causing a divergence.
Yeah, that's essentially
in some sense, yes. It's sort of three and a half dimensional, so.
Yeah, it's actually
four. Mm-hmm. So to summarize, we've given evidence that general defect conformal field theories can indeed be described holographically. We showed that sort of for generic interactions on the gravity side, you can reproduce the simplest correlators using the gravity. How so?
Because you're not getting cancellations. You're just getting some convergence.
Yes.
But
that's a good point.
The two-point function of the photon, the beta function, doesn't cancel. It's just zero.
Right.
Just
that's a very good point. So the additional contributions could, in principle, depend on the coupling as much as they want. They just don't diverge.
Yeah.
Good point, yeah, that is very true. And we also showed that besides this general case, that in particular for this Karch-Randall system, the open string fluctuations of the ADS4 cross S25 brain match exactly with a set of defect operators for our proposed dual field theory. And finally, we constructed this novel defect superconformal field theory with Lagrangian description, and showed that at least in some cases, and hopefully at all, it is in fact conformal. So in the future, besides completing this conformality, it'd be interesting to investigate whether there are protected correlators in more detail. It'd be interesting to investigate the closed string operator map in some more detail. And maybe more speculatively in the future, it would be nice to consider examples where you have a non-conformal quantum field theory with some sort of defect dual to some more complicated configuration of brains and maybe fluxes on the gravity side. So I'll stop there. More questions?
So the Karch-Randall, I guess both brains are supposed to be in a regime where they're gravitational solutions rather than actual brains.
To obtain locally localized gravity, that's true. Because
right.
You really need the gravitational back reaction to locally localize anything.
I mean, there might be.
So what were they trying to do actually? What was the physics?
So the physics, basically, the Karch and Randall said is, okay, we know in the Randall-Sundrum case that you get this sort of graviton-bound state, even though you have an infinite fifth dimension. They said, what if I detune the parameters ever so slightly, such that the 4D cosmological constant is no longer exactly zero, but goes one direction or the other? When it becomes slightly de Sitter, it turns out that the graviton is bound all the more strongly. When it becomes slightly anti-de Sitter, it becomes no longer a bound state, but they hope to show that this tiny change in the parameters should not change the physics drastically. And so they tried to show that there is some approximate localization of gravity, even though at great distances, gravity has to look five-dimensional. Any more questions?